Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper, deeper. Sorry.
Wow, he did his own echo.
Thank you. I try. I am your host, Eddie Van Wilden. Alongside me, as always, are the dynamic duo Spencer Williams and Chad Riley. I thought I'd mix it up a little bit and see if Chad would answer to Spencer and Spencer would answer to Chad.
But then you kept talking, so we couldn't.
Great job.
How dare you?
Flawlessly.
What?
Flawless. You pulled it off flawlessly.
Thank you. I try. We got a great show in store for you as we're going to be talking about Pixar's latest creation, Incredibles 2, so stick around. But before we do, Chad, hit him with a little bit of that information.
I sure would love to. We may have no capes, but the Filmlosophers podcast is definitely still in action, presented as always by Mingle Media TV and recorded live each week at VGB Studios. Are you ready for more heroic news in your week? We stream new episodes each week on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Libsyn, Player FM, and Audio Boom. They drop on Wednesday mornings. Spencer, what else can they do?
Don't freeze up on your social life.
I never freeze.
Oh, sorry. My just God. Oh. Oh, my God. Stretch yourself a little bit and connect with us on social media. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers and follow us on Twitter.
You broke him.
I broke him.
Twitter.com/filmlosophy101.
Wakanda forever.
Finally, you can access our entire library of Black Panther episodes on our website at filmlosophers.com.
Heck yeah.
Plus other stuff. We do other stuff. I mean, we did Black Panther once, and the other 116 episodes, we did other stuff.
Yeah, Black Panther appears in a few episodes pertaining to Infinity War.
True. So, okay. So,
you know.
Three?
It's valid.
Four?
There are
four
multiple episodes.
Okay. Well. I never.
I'll allow it.
As we said, we have a great show in store, and we're kind of excited because we got to go see a press screening, so a pre-screening of the film Incredibles 2. This film has been so many years in the making, so much anticipation has
How
been
built.
How
many years?
I want to say at least 14. I believe it was 14.
Yeah, for sure.
So a lot of people, a lot of fans, actually a lot of the people who are anticipating this film are older. And it's funny, I saw a tweet one time not too long ago where it said, if you're planning to go see Incredibles 2, don't take your whiny kids. This movie isn't meant for them. It's for everybody who saw it 14 years ago.
Wow.
Want to see the follow-up. So we got a chance to see the film.
It's a little harsh.
Well, I mean, you kind of have to agree.
A little self-centered. I
mean, exactly.
Why not share the love?
Never. So before we get into it, Chad, why don't you give him a little bit of that official synopsis goodness?
Sure thing. Helen, voiced by Holly Hunter, is called on to lead a campaign to bring supers back, while Bob, voiced by Craig T. Nelson, navigates the day-to-day heroics of quote-unquote normal life at home with Violet, Dash, and baby Jack-Jack, whose superpowers are about to be discovered. Their mission is derailed, however, when a new villain emerges with a brilliant and dangerous plot that threatens everything. But the Pars don't shy away from a challenge, especially with Frozone, voiced by Samuel L. Jackson, by their side. That's what makes this family so incredible.
There you go. Right on that one. Nice. Directed by Brad Bird, the film sees the return of vocal talents Craig T. Nelson, Holly Hunter, Sarah Vowell, Huck Milner, and Samuel L. Jackson, as well as some new voices such as Bob Odenkirk, Catherine Keener, Sophia Bush, and Bill Wise, among others. This film is a sequel to 2004's The Incredibles, both of which are written and directed by Brad Bird. Bird also voices the enigmatic Edna Mode.
Edna Mode.
The Incredibles will be the fifth Pixar film to become a franchise following Toy Story, Cars, Monsters, Inc., and Finding Nemo. As we were mentioning earlier, this film has been 14 years in the making. This was announced back in April of 2014, that they were going to be making it, that they actually began the storyboarding and whatnot, and that Brad was going to be creating a new and unique story as part of the follow-up. I actually remember an article not too long ago before that that stated that Brad Bird was not going to create a follow-up to 2004's Incredibles unless there was a good enough story that actually would be better than the first one. Like, he wanted to do something that was actually better, that would exceed.
Which is a really great rule of thumb for any sequel ever.
100%. Yeah.
There's too many sequels out there that don't even try to match the original's quality.
Yeah, or reboots for that matter. Mm-hmm. That should be doubly true of reboots.
Oh, no doubt. Like, if anything, you should actually state that. That should be part of, like, the contract. Like, oh, you're going to Sony because you want to reboot this franchise? Okay. Well, first stipulation is it has to be good. Secondly, it has to be better than the previous one.
True.
So, I don't know.
I feel like you were talking about Fan4Stick for a second.
I was exactly talking about Fan4Stick. God above. That movie should come with that stipulation every time. I don't care who gets it next. That movie needs to be done right. It's like a stone that keeps rolling downhill. It's not coming back up. We should just say goodbye.
It's just gathering no moss.
It is waving by. It is
because we are not clinging on to it. We are just letting it go.
Good job opening that wound, Spencer. Thank you.
I'm not the one who said Sony.
What were we talking about again? Oh, Incredibles.
Incredibles 2.
So as we
how
said,
how could we not be talking about it?
Because you said Fan4Stick. How do you not get derailed when you get the opportunity?
I'm sorry. You know, I didn't realize that was a trigger word
here's the
for
thing.
Somebody.
The Fantastic Four is Marvel's first family. It's a family of superheroes. So I think that there is some connection here because the Incredibles are a family of superheroes done better.
Yeah. They even have one extra member.
Yeah, they do. And he is amazing.
So like we said, we got a chance to check it out. We got a chance to view the entire film. And we got some really great stuff to say about the film. But before we do, there's a little bit of a tradition that Pixar has when it comes to their films.
Oh, yeah.
And they've always been known, so far as I've known, I don't think I've ever seen a Pixar film that didn't do this, but Pixar usually releases a short before their animated feature. You know, whether if it's the short about, you know, the lava,
right,
which was a really great one.
So good.
And then you have the ones like the Battle of the Little Downtown Square with the two musicians that are playing for the coin from the little girl.
Or you have that one with the chess player who's playing himself.
Ah, uh-huh. The very first
very
one.
Very classic right there.
The Bird on a Wire.
Yeah, Bird on a Wire. Ones. These are all great.
Yeah.
Like these, they're iconic at this point. Because
and
I mean,
very memorable.
Oh, yeah. For good reason, too, because they're well done. They're engaging. They're cute.
And they usually have no dialogue.
They usually don't. Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen one that didn't have dialogue in it.
That did have dialogue.
That I'm sorry, that did have dialogue.
Didn't see one that did have dialogue.
There you go.
There you go. There you go.
They don't talk. They emote.
They emote. So, with that said,
bow.
We had a chance to see the short that was going to accompany this film, simply titled Bao, B-A-O. Now, if you're not familiar with the word, bao is it's a Chinese term meaning a food. That is it's a roll with a piece of meat or a meat mixture that is cooked at the center of it. They're very delicious. I actually had one today, ironically. There was a farmer's market not too far down the street from my work. And I saw it and I bought it and it didn't click until I was looking at it and I'm like,
what did you do, Eddie? What have you done?
So this short. And I'll explain what I did to the bow after, you know, I explain the short. This short is really interesting because it ultimately is the story of a wife.
All I have to say is if you pulled out a pen or a marker and doodled on this bow, we're going to have words later.
Oh, I should have taken pictures. So it's this short about this Asian couple and the husband and the wife are sitting down to have a meal and the husband eats quickly and he leaves, leaving the wife to sadly eat alone. And all of a sudden she bites into a pork bao or a bao and it cries.
Like a baby.
Like a baby. Like a child baby.
And it has a face.
This bao begins to sprout ears and
appendages. Okay, and this was the most upsetting part, where like it's just a piece of food sitting there, and then all of a sudden, just a body sprouts out of it. I was like, what is happening in this short? Why is this happening?
I think there was a collective, huh, in the theater.
Absolutely. There was.
This so quick side note.
By the way, everybody, we're gonna spoil the short, but we're not gonna spoil the movie.
That's
true.
Exactly what we're
doing. So just so you know,
because
I'm trying to give Spencer a little time to turn on the soundboard, because you know how Spencer's in charge of that soundboard. So just so you know, there's no sound for this.
I've got one. Keep going.
There will be spoilers for the short.
Spoiler warning. We have all these warnings. They're all going.
What was that?
Honestly, every time I try to do something fun or exciting, you make it not that.
What in God's name is that? It's still going.
That was the best accident that's ever happened.
It's next to all the action sounds. Why is that there?
You were supposed to arrange
you
it.
You put that one there. I know you did.
I did. Okay. Anyways. So there'll be spoiler warnings for the short, but we're not going to get into spoilers for the film. So if you're wondering if you're going to have to skip this whole episode until next time, don't worry, because we're not going to talk about anything pertinent.
We'll gloss over anything that's truly deeply important.
Yeah.
Plot-wise. For the film. But Bao, we're going to talk about.
Yeah, we're gonna dive into this.
We
for
need
a second.
Some psychological assistance here.
That is the easiest way
to
say it.
Makes a body for itself, essentially sprouts a body out of itself and becomes her little baby Bao.
Which started my first question. Like, you know, she's just looking at this Bao and then she like just hugs it, and I'm like, what? That's your first move, not the like, I need to take
not
you
freak
to
out not and
scientists.
Call the authorities.
If Where there's are the anything, scientists? Explain.
If there's anything that says anthropomorphic food, usually a couple things begin to sprout up in terms of mindsets. Number one, I'm calling an exorcist. Number two, I'm calling a scientist. And number three, I'm finding a weapon immediately. Because you don't know what this thing is. You don't even know if it's human. You may have accidentally cooked it, and for God knows, I mean, it's getting ready to burrow into your chest.
You could be pretty sure it's not human. I mean, it's the size of, like, your palm.
Your palm. Mm. It's, yeah. So she begins to care for this thing as it is, as if it were her child. She protects it. She's holding on to it.
She feeds it
raw meat, mind you, which is the first sign that it's a, you know, cannibal, or it's going to eat her or something. It's like the whole Little Shop of Horrors thing. He's going to eat her.
Which, okay. I mean, given the musical cues, that's probably not going to happen, but okay.
Feed me, Seymour!
Just kidding. Oh, boy. She does take it shopping.
She puts clothes on it.
It grows up.
She does, what is that? What is that in the park?
Tai Chi. Yeah, she's doing Tai Chi in the park.
With it, there's not really a set time frame as to how much time is passing.
And he wants to like play soccer with the other kids, and he's very vulnerable, so his little head keeps getting smushed in different ways, and she has to rebuild it.
There's a scene
by
where
feeding him food.
There's a scene where his head caves in because he hits a ball with his head,
and he's only a bow,
and his head caves in, and the first thing you immediately think is, this thing's gonna have brain damage. But it's very interesting, this whole thing. And then so it transitions into like instantaneously into different generations,
growth stages of his existence. You're not sure if it's all in one day or over the course of years, what the husband ever thinks about it, because you don't see the husband for quite a while.
Right. No, like he promptly left early on in that one.
So she's just with this Bao, it's growing up. Eventually, it becomes pretty surly.
Yeah.
It doesn't like all the attention that she's giving it.
It grows a little goatee, which I don't know where it got the hair from.
Well, it basically embraces thug life.
It does, because...
Oh, my gosh.
I told you I had a sound
I
ready
forgot
for you.
That
I
you guys were going to use that.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Please continue.
apparently this bow gets to a point where it runs away from the mother and takes off with some friends, comes back.
Human friends, by the way.
Human friends, mm-hmm. Yes, which he is completely like a fraction of the size of everybody else. He's not growing like at the same rate as they are or even as big as they are. He is extremely small compared to the rest of them.
He is growing, though. I mean, she does the whole growth thing on the marking on the doorpost with the pencil.
True. And then when he comes back, he apparently got married.
Engaged, at least.
Or at least engaged to a normal-sized woman.
A human female.
And tells, or in so many ways, gestures to the mother that he's leaving, goes and grabs some suitcases, and starts walking towards the door.
And here is the special moment of the short, is when mom is trying to stop her son, Bao, from leaving the home.
Her Bao son Bao. So in the event that she does not want him to leave, they are arguing back and forth. She is pulling on him to keep him from going out the door with the woman that is blonde, the significant other.
The fiancé.
And in a moment of immense emotion, the mother decides to pick up her son, Bao, and proceeds to swallow him in one bite.
I jumped in my seat when that happened. I was like,
What if that was his whole plan? Like, what if he just needed to be eaten so he could sprout out from within her? I've seen Alien.
You don't eat your kids.
Why did you jump to Alien? This whole infanticide thing is a bigger issue.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
She ate her son in one bite.
Like, that's no different from you having a dog than one day being like, I'm going to eat you, and then you cook him up.
I'm just saying.
You
aliens.
Do have a small dog.
I do. Well, yeah, but I've never looked at him like, you know what? I'm kind of hungry this afternoon. Yeah, just
because normal sane people don't.
Don't eat your children, people.
This whole thing happens in the blink of an eye, and it's instantaneous. She grabs it, tosses it in her mouth, swallows, doesn't even chew.
No, just straight down to the stomach.
And closes the door. And then realizes what she's done and goes to the bedroom to sulk, essentially. What we find out is, for some reason, she actually has a real son
who looks like the Bao.
Who looks like the Bao, like exactly.
Has the goatee, has the glasses.
Mm-hmm. And this apparently is some kind of like parallel to whatever happened with the mom and the son. And they kind of reconcile by both consuming bows, like a ceremonial, like cannibalistic ritual.
I mean, he's
here.
Growing up and leaving the home, and she can't.
But
deal
what
with
child's
it.
gonna grasp that?
But you don't know. Yeah, you don't know what's happening until.
No,
the
I
end.
Know what's happening. She's on an acid trip. Is what's happening. That's the only explanation for that entire short.
That's why we haven't seen the husband. He's on an acid trip somewhere halfway to work.
Oh God!
So this short is not.
It definitely gets your attention.
It does, and it will stick with you whether you want it to or not.
I mean, I don't think you were the only person, Spencer, in that theater who jumped. I mean, there was like gasping. There was audible. Like what? There was a lot going on.
I was shocked and surprised and unsure and. At that point, I was not certain I wanted to continue with this movie. And that was only 5 minutes into it.
Yeah, I was like, if this is the opener, this is supposed to get you ready for Incredibles 2. What in the world is in that movie?
I'm like, I don't even want to know. I don't. I'm good. So we say all that to say, Pixar, what are you thinking?
Who hurt you?
Who hurt you? Who hurt you?
Oh, that was good. Also, Pixar has a tradition with all of their movies to name at the end of the credits the production babies. And at the end of this short, you've got all the production bows, and it has names of the kids from the people who worked on the short. What babies were born during the making of the short.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I could have done without the bow just bring back the old man playing chess. Let's see him play Battleship or something. I mean, I'd rather see that again than whatever. I mean, and even the animation in this thing, like, I'm all for, I love movies like Coraline and all that, but this seemed so out of place and out of character for what we're used to. Mm-hmm. It seemed, I don't know, it seemed very off to what I'm used to expecting when it comes.
I mean, I think the shorts have a pretty good diversity of styles and things. If you look at all of them over the span of time, you know, I think that animation-wise, it was unique and distinctive and different from the ones that have come before. Doesn't excuse eating your child.
Yeah, like, I thought the animation style was cool. I was like, oh, they're branching out a bit. And then I was instantly distracted by what was happening in the short.
I don't know. Just like the way the mother was, you know, animated and whatnot, it seemed really interesting for me. I never could see her eyes. I could never make out certain things. It just, I don't know. For me, it didn't sit too well. But then again, hey, I got nightmares from it. So thanks, Pixar.
I mean, we're talking about it.
If that's their goal, they won.
It's definitely unforgettable.
Unforgettable.
We're not going to play that song.
No, not that way. No.
So, moving forward, after the short, obviously, we jump right into the actual main action, and we all begin to see the unique colors. We hear the distinct music, and Incredibles 2 begins exactly how Incredibles 1 leaves us, with the Underminer and everything happening there, and... I have to say, you have to appreciate this film starting exactly where many people were hoping it was going to start at, which was at the tail end of the first one, with that whole sequence of events happening, seeing how it plays out. This film doesn't really deviate, or it doesn't take place like further down the road than the first film. It's literally a continuation of the same story.
Yeah, I mean, it in the very, very beginning is an interrogation sequence of sorts. So there's a bit of a transition moment. And then, yeah, you move into the proper continuation mm-hmm. of how the first one ended 14 years ago. And it's fun. It's interesting because if this was a live action film that was a sequel to a live action film from 14 years ago, you would not be able to do this. You'd have to recast everybody because everybody aged 14 years. You wouldn't have, you know, preteen Violet, kid Dash, baby Jack, like they would be grown partially.
Oh yeah, 100%.
So it's fun because, you know, given the medium of the movie, you can literally pick up right where you left off, which is unique to choose to do that, like literally almost instantaneously.
Oh, 100%.
From where the original did that cliffhanger.
Yeah.
That fun cliffhanger.
And I think this is a clear indication of, you know, individuals like Brad Bird and powers that be actually listening to what the fans were wanting. Like, you're waiting 14 years for a film. You really need to make sure this film hits it out of the park. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm all for giving film space and allowing the anticipation to build. I mean, if anything did that, Star Wars was one of those ones that really kind of capitalized on the anticipation of years between films, but they still came out with them. This is 14 years after the first one. Either you're going to hit this out of the park or this is going to be a major dud. And I think this is kind of the indicator of what was to expect with the rest of the film in terms of, yes, we heard you. We know you want to know what happened in this story. So we're going to drop you right in the center of that. We are introduced back into the world of the Parr family, which I believe takes place during the 50s or 60s. I don't ever remember a time frame.
Yeah, it's kind of...
It's like a fake 60s,
yeah,
50s-ish.
It kind of occupies this false time. Because some things are very modern and some things are very dated.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because everything is extremely unique to that particular time, whichever it's that like distinct time between the 50s and 60s and whatnot, as the world is still changing and transitioning into new generations and whatnot. You're going from like that whole cowboy mindset to the new age of like space exploration, all that kind of stuff. So we're reintroduced back into that. We're seeing the Parr family as we recognize them from the first film. Obviously, you have Violet, who has the ability to create force fields. We see Dash.
Who, and turn invisible.
And turn invisible, mm-hmm. That's right. We have Dash, who is super fast. He runs really fast. Obviously, Helen, who is Elastigirl. The name kind of speaks for itself. And then Bob, who is Mr. Incredible, who is super strong. What's really cool is right out the get-go, as soon as you start, you actually see that Violet has a new, or not so much a new ability, but it's kind of like a fun new like development of her abilities where she's throwing force fields now mm-hmm. instead of just creating them. So I thought that was pretty cool. As we're introduced to the characters, obviously, we're also introduced to back into Frozone, voiced by Samuel L. Jackson, who is always... I half expect him to cuss in just about everything he does. So I'm slightly surprised that they didn't try to fit something in there because they tried to fit one in there into... I'm just saying...
They would not put that in a
they
Pixar
They fit
movie.
One into the end of Infinity War, so I'm just saying...
That's Infinity War.
I know.
That's not Pixar. Samuel, it's not a cartoon.
Samuel L. Jackson, though. After that, we're introduced to newer characters, such as the Devers... am I saying that right? The Devers?
Yeah, I mean, it should be pronounced Devers, by the way they spell it. But yeah, it's Devers.
Devers. We got you got Winston Deaver, which is played by Bob Odenkirk. If you're not familiar with who that is, he's the
Better
individual.
Better Call Saul.
He was in Better Call Saul. Then you got Evelyn Deaver, who is played by Catherine Keener, who just recently, if you're not too familiar with her, she was the mother in Get Out. Mm-hmm. Creepy in that movie.
Very creepy.
So the introduction back into this world and kind of back into the fray of making heroes legal is kind of the main storyline of this film. Would you guys agree? Just making, because obviously there's been a certain amount of time where being a hero has been outlawed, and that's all explained in the first film. In this one, there's a huge push to kind of make this campaign of why superheroes should become legal again.
It's an interesting juxtaposition to what we do see in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which in that environment, the heroes are forced to, you know, sign the Accords, the Sokovia Accords, or their rogue elements, and, you know, need to be pursued and prosecuted, put in prison, you know, etc. So, obviously, The Incredibles, the first film, had a dynamic, not that intense, but a dynamic like that going on before the MCU, you know, took form on the screen. Mm-hmm. So, but I do think if you're a fan of kind of all things Disney, then you've likely seen enough of the MCU movies to be relatively current on that whole dynamic of like when superheroes get involved, there's tremendous property damage, loss of life, emotional distress, etc., things that happen. And wouldn't it be better if they didn't get involved? Because they tend to escalate things when they're trying to be helpful. So the most helpful thing is just stop altogether.
Yeah.
So this film kind of takes that whole mentality and takes the next step and says, okay, well, if we're going to try to make a good name for ourselves again, how are we going to do that? Because these concerns are valid. So it's an interesting sort of almost a continuation of a dialogue that's happening in another corner of Disney's, you know, owned properties. I'll say they don't exist in the same universe that we know of.
That we know
but,
of.
In terms of properties that Disney owns, I mean, you've got it's quite an interesting continuation of something that's, you know, very current in that other mega franchise.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to because I know obviously this film was done back in 2000. The first film, the franchise itself, had begun back in 2004, but still to continue on that arc of almost paralleling, is that how you say it? When you parallel, almost in a parallel of what their mega franchise is doing. It seems kind of like, okay, we're going to do the PG version while you guys do the PG-13 and kind of push the line, whatever.
Sure.
I think it's a risk because yes, it's its own entity, like you were saying, but to kind of create that similar feeling and emotion, you know, that arc that, you know, we need to try to get these heroes out of the darkness and into the light, let people see them, let people know that they're good people and whatnot. And it does seem, now that I'm talking about it, it does seem like a little bit like Civil War. The nature of this film. You have also a new foe in this one, which has a really...
Screen Slayer.
Has the most ridiculous name.
Well, okay,
I've been Screen Slaver.
Screen Slaver.
I didn't say it right.
I've been thinking about this for a few days. I was like, that name is so terrible. But like at the same time, the person who made it is a tech person. And I know tech people, and we're kind of bad at naming things a lot of times.
So you're saying the name was given to somebody from IT?
I'm just saying the person who made it was an IT person, a creator of technology.
Here's a little bit, just total like sidetrack thing. But
okay,
which had the worst name, Screenslaver, or the idea that Han Solo's last name was given to him in the way that it was?
Screenslaver.
Absolutely.
Screenslaver.
I'm just
Screenslaver.
Okay.
Kidding me?
Okay.
This is a put on Screensaver.
It's a cartoon. Take it easy.
She ate her child. I can't.
It all goes back to that.
Yeah, this is where it's all stemming from.
The answer
from.
To Spencer's question from before, who hurt you? The answer to his question is Bao.
Apparently. And the idea of this character. So this individual is a high-tech villain who utilizes the airwaves to brainwash
hypnotize
individuals who are watching to do his bidding, his or her bidding, their bidding, whatever bidding. And so that becomes the focus of Elastigirl. And so she's on this big mission to try to take down Screenslaver while also promoting, you know, good superheroes.
I mean, she kind of is agreed upon to be the face of why we should allow superheroes again, because she's relatable, she doesn't cause as much damage as like her husband and several of the others, so she's the best bet from a marketing standpoint, if you will, for convincing the general public and lawmakers to reinstitute superheroes and not make them against the law anymore.
I so
none of that's really too spoilery because a lot of it's in the trailers.
It is. Yeah. Completely.
It's at least indicated in the trailers.
From a marketing perspective, I did like the fact that they included like a ton of infographs and risk assessments on Mr. Incredible as to why he should not be the person to be the poster person for their campaign.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty interesting. I just liked the idea that somebody did the research, or supposedly did the research. But that's essentially what the film is about. I mean, like we said, we're not going to go into details. We're not going to go into specifics because we want you to enjoy this film. But, some of the key things that really stand out to me is the first question that I have for you guys. And I want to ask, did you feel like this film was as emotionally deep as the first film? 'Cause I was thinking about it and I was like, I remember the first film, and I remember in the first film, like towards the tail end, there's that scene where Mr. Incredible has with Elastigirl, and it's like, he's like, I'm not strong enough, and Bob, he's like, and that whole just explosion scene of emotion where he's like, oh, you know, I'm not strong enough. If I lose you, I can't go through that again, blah, blah, blah. It was a pretty powerful scene. I don't know if I got that with this particular film. Now, it had a lot of other great parts, like it did. I'm just, in terms of that, because that was one of the key things I remembered from the first Incredibles, that type of emotional, you know, perspective. I don't know.
I mean, I think that the consistency angle in this film is that Mr. Incredible's arc is the more emotional arc, which is a nice reversal of the norm. I mean, you typically have, if you have a male lead and a female lead, no matter if it's an animated film or a live action or, you know, what have you, paper mache, I don't know. You know, puppets, I whatever. The standard, the traditional mode is, you know, stolid, strong, stalwart guy showing his strength and the emotional vulnerability and the emotional arc tends to be more owned by the female character.
Mm-hmm.
In this film, similar to the first Incredibles, actually Mr. Incredible has the more of the emotional weight of the story than Elastigirl, who's out having a fun time, knows that she's accomplishing the goal of making heroes good, like popular again, and feeling rewarded to be in the spotlight instead of, you know, taking a back seat. And he's now in the role of, you know, homemaker, taking care of the kids, learning a whole new version of math, and and dealing with Jack-Jack as things develop there. So
yeah,
all of that and the arc that Mr. Incredible goes through, his is the more emotional arc in the story. That being said, I would agree it's not as potent as what he goes through in the first film.
Which, mind you, I'm not saying that's a deal breaker for me, because I think this film also has a lot of shining moments. It has a ton of, you know, funny, hilarious moments that stand out. But before we jump into those, what do you think, Spence? How do you feel on that?
I kind of agree with both of you guys. I feel like this movie, like, it doesn't go to that emotional depth like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I also don't think it really needed to tread there as much, because it had like a lot of other things just going on for it, like with humor and action. It was kind of more of an upbeat film than than the last one was.
Which I would say, if you compared this one to other superhero films, I mean, we were making the jokes about Fanforstic earlier, and obviously referencing the MCU. A lot of the momentum of comic book adaptation movies that have superheroes is to go grittier, darker, more quote-unquote realistic, less bright colors, happy fun time. And I think that the Incredibles franchise just has more of that brightness to it, regardless of, you know, whether or not it has emotional depth. I think that this is a nice counterpoint to literally, I mean, spoiler alert, literally a month and a half ago, seeing half of the Avengers or better turn to dust. So most moviegoers are at least aware that something really dark, sinister, and upsetting happened in Infinity War.
Yeah.
And so it's nice to have a film where you don't have all of that, like, angst present. I mean, there's enough transformational, like, emotional transformation here to make you satisfied, but it's not angsty.
Yeah.
It's actually really fun.
And you know what? Like I said, I have to agree. Like I was saying, it where it lacks in the emotional depth, it does make up for it in the comedic parts. Like, this film was really funny. Like, I don't know about you guys, but the stealer of the show for me of this entire film, Jack-Jack.
Of course.
Hands down.
I would qualify that even further. I mean, yeah, Jack-Jack was amazing. Jack-Jack and Edna Mode together. I've said this about other characters in other properties before.
Uh-huh.
If they release 10 full-length movies of Jack-Jack and Edna Mode and nobody else, I would watch them. I would skip work. I would watch them back to back to back to back. It was that enjoyable.
You know what Pixar should do is release a short with both Jack-Jack and Edna Mode where Edna doesn't eat Jack-Jack.
Yeah. Which she didn't do.
We did not have
part two in the middle of this film.
Thankfully, that was definitely not a reprisal that we had to worry about. I think, though, I do have to agree that was a great scene, like seeing both of them, just the way he's mirroring her as they're walking down the hallway.
Oh, my gosh.
The look on Bob's face as he's seeing Jack-Jack just act so appropriate when he's with Edna. And after going through, like, pretty much heck and back with the baby at the house. But for me, hands down, the funniest scene in the movie when Jack-Jack is, quote-unquote, defending the house from the raccoon.
Sure.
That was the most funniest part I have ever seen in a cartoon movie. And I don't know who voiced that baby, but it sounded like a baby. And I am almost willing to see if there's a way that we can see that scene again. Just... yeah, that was so hilarious.
Well, there is a way. You can go buy a ticket to the film and not go for free.
Thank you. Thank you for your lovely knowledge.
I like to
knowledge.
Support with finances. things that are good and worth supporting. So yes, you can buy a ticket and see the movie at your own expense.
But
you have movie pass anyway. Don't sigh at me. Gosh.
Call you out on the podcast.
You know what? Whatever.
We all do. We have to see these things for free no matter what, okay? We don't have the money.
We're not there with this podcast.
Truly everything with Jack-Jack in this movie is utterly enjoyable.
Yeah.
Like there wasn't a scene with him in it that I didn't love.
And the great thing is that the majority of the scenes in the film do have him in it, so it makes them all the more enjoyable.
Yeah, because even if he's in the background, he's funny.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Mm-hmm. I think a really good follow-up to Jack-Jack, I think another funny particular character was seeing the... I liked the evolution of Violet's confidence in this particular film. I don't know if you guys saw about the first film where she had all this confidence and she was able to talk to the guy of her dreams and whatnot, and this is not after the first film. This kind of follows up on that and sees where that confidence goes, and I liked the way... It was a way that I wasn't expecting, in all honesty. Like, I was expecting to see, oh, well, she's now super popular. She's super confident. She's doing all these things. And it's still, she's still an angsty young preteen who is dealing with emotions as well as boys and all these things. And a dad who wants to be her friend. And it's so great to see how this whole thing plays out. One of the highlights for me, honestly.
I think that they did a great job making each child behave like a child that age. Mm-hmm. Like, each of the children really stands out in this movie for distinctive reasons. Like, they are very much, I mean, for as much as they're animated, they're incredibly authentic. The way that they process what's going on around them, the way that they try to help out, the way that they try to rise to the occasion, be it as heroes or just as like students in school or whatever, you know, what have you. I really thought it was like you're watching a family.
Yeah, easily.
And it just happens to have superpowers.
And it's great because I think the great thing that they always tend to relay with these types of films, and they did it so well in the first one as well and in this one, is the relatability that you create with the characters. Whether or not if you're a mom who wants to do more than above and be, you know, what she can, you know, for the family, to the father who is trying to be a good dad and, you know, help, like you were saying, help with math, help with whatever. Or if you're a young kid who has so much energy that you just can't stop running and you talk and you get yourself into trouble and you don't do your homework and all that kind of stuff. Or you're an angsty teen. Or, I mean, if you're a baby and you relate to a baby, hey, by all means. But this film has so many enjoyable aspects and so many ways that you can connect that it's really well done that way. And I think Brad Bird deserves pretty much the majority of that credit because he wrote the piece, he directed it and wrote it. And, yeah,
and he did the original too. I mean, I think it makes a huge difference. A lot of times when you explore, especially after this length of time, when you explore continuing a story or rebooting a story, whatever you do, you want to bring in fresh creative talent and you know, do all these new things. And I think that the continuity is really what sells this film, and that comes. I mean, obviously, they have a large team, as you can see as the credits are scrolling.
Oh, yeah.
A very large team. But having that kind of common, consistent, creative vision at the helm makes a huge difference. It helps this film feel totally in line with the original, but also expanding the canvas, if you will, like extending the themes that you saw before, building new layers of nuance into it, and ultimately being just as fulfilling, if not more so, than the original.
And I think he's kind of known for doing that. I mean, if you look at some of his previous stuff, this is the man who wrote and directed The Iron Giant. And if any animated film pulls at those heartstrings as hard as they can, it's The Iron Giant. Like, if you haven't seen that movie, 1999, great film. One of those films where Vin Diesel actually did a good role. Just saying, he's the voice of the giant.
Vin Diesel as a voice actor, fantastic.
Yeah, he's knocking it out of the park. Him as an actor, not so much. I could do it.
We don't need to talk about that, really.
Thankfully. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Are you thinking about the bow again?
No.
Well, we
we're
are now.
Forward. We're moving forward.
But you take somebody who's capable of creating like that type of engaging storytelling, and you incorporate it into like a really fun package, like a family of superheroes. That's a force to be reckoned with in my mind. I mean, sadly, he's the same guy who did Tomorrowland, and I don't know what happened there, but that wasn't a very good film in my mind. I think you were didn't you come with me when we went to go see it, Spencer?
Yeah, I was there for some reason.
He was just there to see George Clooney. That's all we're going to say.
Well, you think he would do a better job.
But also, like, this is the same guy who did Ratatouille, and, you know.
He also did Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, which, while it was a departure, it really was a compelling extension of that franchise.
Now, Ghost Protocol, that's the one where... Oh, yeah.
He's up on the side of the really tall building, and Simon Pegg
shows
up. Mm-hmm.
That one was a good one. I really liked
that
one.
It was a good one.
The problem with, you know, I can't stand Mission Impossible movies. They just tend to be the same thing over and over again. But there are certain ones, like Ghost Protocol, that actually really do a great job. But Brad Bird, like I said, he's a great director. He's a great writer. I'm anxious to see him do something really substantial. Like, I really want to see him, like, branch out into something big, like something unique. I don't know.
Because multiple Pixar films isn't big.
Multiple as in 14 years between the first and the second?
Well and Ratatouille and, you know, all that. Like, I mean, that's...
True. You're right. True. I don't know, though. I really hope that as Pixar continues to grow... I mean, obviously, we're already working on stuff like the, you know, enlarging the Star Wars universe. Obviously, the MCU is just continuing to grow. Like, there's no stopping that boulder. As more and more films continue to get added to these large franchises, I think somebody like Brad Bird deserves a seat at that table. Like, I would like to see Brad Bird quite possibly do a Marvel film. Like, something that can really speak towards that particular demographic and still be within the universe itself.
Well, maybe they'll give him Fantastic Four once they finish buying 20th Century Fox.
Because that would be kind of a good matchup. It's like, hey, do live-action Incredibles with these characters.
You can even have Samuel L. Jackson say a bad word. I don't know. I just, for me, I really hope that the biggest thing with Disney is that they like to keep people in silos. They keep people, like, kind of compartmentalized to their own thing. And so Pixar writers and creators, they stay over there. These people over here. These people over there.
Well, but you have to consider, too, Pixar is its own company.
Right.
Like,
I thought they were combined into...
He's a Pixar person. So there is some carryover. Mm-hmm. John Lasseter was the main carryover. And then there were some negative things about, you know, conduct and whatnot. And so he stepped aside. But the Pixar brain trust, if you will... works in partnership with Disney Studios. They are not owned. I don't believe Disney ever purchased Pixar. And the keys start clacking.
Because that is not what I thought happened.
I could have.
It's a long term.
Owned by Walt Disney Company. Yeah.
Oh, maybe they did ultimately purchase them at some point.
That is a subsidiary.
They used to be their own thing.
Yeah. It used to be. I thought, like, what was it, like 8 years ago? They bought them or something? I don't know.
A while back.
Well, okay. I stand corrected, but they're still Pixar employees, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, like, they're still, yes, if you're a subsidiary, you're owned by the mothership, if you will, and they can tell you what to do, but you're still primarily an employee of that company. And honestly, when it comes to creative people like this, they're not really even owned by the company they work for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oftentimes you'll have directors especially who form their own production companies and then get hired on by a Universal or a Disney or a Warner's or something. And yeah, they are working with that studio for that project, or they're contracted for five projects or whatever it is, but mm-hmm. they own a production company, and their production company is part of that contract. And so, you know, they're making money and getting that nest egg nice and polished. you know, so it, it, yeah, employee of, but also free to make your own decisions. True. I think in creative pursuits, that's really valuable, especially in that upper echelon realm.
You're right. You're right. And the only reason why I even kind of throw this notion out is because of the fact that he was given Tomorrowland to do with as he pleases. And we all know how that rolled out and how it was not as successful as everybody anticipated. But, you know, seeing those kinds of opportunities, I would like to see, just like I said, him have a seat at the bigger table is kind of what I'm just thinking. Just because he's a great writer and he's a great visionary when it comes to things like this. Like, this man took 14 years to create a film, and I think he did a great job with it.
Mm-hmm.
And in all honesty, I think he excelled my expectations and really just kind of set the bar really high when it comes to the possibility of a third film, in my mind.
So now you're saying, Kevin Feige, you should be knocking on his door.
100%. I mean, I'd like...
Kathleen Kennedy, you should be knocking at his door.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, as weird as it sounds, I wouldn't mind seeing him do an Ewok movie or something.
Oh, what? Now you've gone too far.
No.
I'm just kidding.
Those don't work.
I am not on this train.
Those are proven not to work.
Yes. Oh, you know what? It's one of those... Just, hey, you know, it's a hope. It's a wish.
Why?
Do we have Michael Scott?
No!
There we go.
You heard the man. We don't have Michael Scott. So, before we close this up, was there any last thoughts, any issues that you guys saw with the film? Any inconsistencies?
Not issues, but I wanted to bring up how much I was delighted to hear that incredible soundtrack again.
Yes.
I love the soundtrack for these two films because they're just so distinctive.
Oh, 100%.
Like, the second I heard like the theme song from our own episodes, I was like, yeah. And I kind of like I kind of tuned you guys out for a second. So,
ladies and gentlemen, what you just missed out on is Spencer doing jazz hands.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't care. I love the soundtrack from this movie. And
agreed.
I'm actually
100%.
I'm really waiting for it to just drop so I can buy it.
Yeah, it's true. It was difficult trying to find any kind of music for this film. So finding the actual theme song, which they used in this film, so it's still, you know, definitely makes sense and makes a connection. But that's that theme song that's at the opening. It's very unique because it's not like it. It almost sounds a little bit like the Marvel opener, but it then deviates extremely and has like a jazz 50s kind of vibe to it, like a film noir type listening to it. It's very cool.
Yeah, it's super cool.
Yeah.
I would say in terms of adding a couple of cents to the conversation, I really enjoyed how inventive they got with some of the power sets with the characters. Particularly, there are some new characters that do things. One of them is cool. The other ones are kind of lame. but they do different things. And I really enjoyed, you know, there's a character named Void who, personality-wise, wasn't necessarily my favorite personality. Mm-hmm. But what she can do with her power set and how accomplished she already is with using her powers, I really enjoyed that. You wouldn't necessarily totally get away with that in a live action. I mean, her powers are very similar to Blink from Days of Future Past, which was Fox, not Disney/Marvel. But that takes a lot of planning to get the whole like reel-to-reel, you know, live action environment thing going versus here. It's an entirely made up universe or environment. So you were able to do things a lot faster with that particular type of power. I enjoyed seeing that. I enjoyed, as you mentioned, Violet throwing her force fields.
Yeah.
Jack-Jack is the bomb all the time. He has multiple powers that express themselves over the course of the film.
Yeah.
So some of which you've seen in the previews, others of which are going to be a surprise. Mm-hmm. And all of it was just really fun.
Did they? I think they gave a number at one point.
Yes, they did.
It was 17, right? Yeah. At least 17 powers that you're going to see with Jack-Jack.
Which is especially funny because you don't see all 17 in this film.
Yeah.
It's a number that's thrown out there, which makes you want more.
100%. And I think that's one of the heightened things that I would say is super super cool, and it leaves to the anticipation of having more Jack-Jack be in like future pieces, even those shorts. Like, I would really love to see just a string of shorts, like Chad was saying, of just Jack-Jack with Edna or Jack-Jack and the raccoon.
Yeah, because they already did the one, Jack-Jack Attack, and that was super great.
Yeah,
it was. It was really cool. And that did really well. I think that dropped with the actual like DVD or whatnot when
I
it came
so.
Out.
Yeah. So that sounds about right.
So knowing the way Disney works and the way Marvel and everything else, like putting more like little shorts on the DVD like that for this film, it's going to do really great. I have no doubt like the sales are going to go through the roof.
Well, and I mean, even they have so much gold that they could mine from this particular franchise. They did the whole like tribute to Edna mode a year or two ago where they had real life like fashion designers and celebrities in the fashion space talking about how iconic she is and all this stuff. I mean, that was like genius. And they could totally get away with a dozen other variations on that theme or the Jack-Jack Attack or whatever. There's so much that you could do before it starts to feel stale.
That would be really fun. That'd be really cool to see, like, you know, Captain America's experience with facing off Jack-Jack or the first time he met Jack-Jack or something. I'm just saying that would be a really fun little short.
That would be an interesting mashup. The other thing that I'll say to piggyback off of, Spencer, your comment about the soundtrack, Spencer and I sat through the credit sequence.
Yes. Mm.
And number one, I really enjoyed the presentation of the credit sequence. I know it's kind of a nerdy thing to say, but like, It literally, over the course of the entire credit sequence, you kind of get, in a different order, you get everything that you just saw.
Yeah.
Like, you get reminders of all the stuff that you loved about the movie that just ended. The way that the names are kind of staggered in the credits, it's unique, it's interesting, it's visually engaging. But at the end of the credits, the last minute and a half, 2 minutes, you hear each of the theme songs for Elastigirl, Frozone, and Mr. Incredible, which are brought up early in the film, like the characters themselves are referencing them.
That's cool.
But then, like, the actual, like, jingles for them are done in their entirety, one after the other after the other. So there's definitely a reason. There's no cut scene, but there's definitely a reason to stay all the way.
Yeah, because, like, during the movie, when, like, this guy's singing them, I'm like, they made theme songs for these heroes? I would like to be able to hear them. And then you can, and I'm like, oh, these! I love Frozone's one. It's so cool sounding.
And they're all like totally in the same mode of the rest of the soundtrack. I mean, it's totally of a piece together, and it absolutely works, and it makes it worth it to stay seated.
Yeah, they fit together, and they're also very distinctive.
Yes.
Very cool. So with that, let's go around and see if it passes or fails and how many monocles. And let's go ahead and start with Senor Chad.
Ooh, I get to go first. That never happens. First post. sorry, that was so 15 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah, no, I would say it definitely passes for me. I would give it 4.5 out of 5 monocles, possibly 4.8-ish. Actually, I'll go ahead, 4.8. I want to see the movie again. I wanted to see the movie again immediately. Like, as the credits were rolling, I wanted to watch it again because I enjoyed it so much. It was just fun. Like, start to finish, fun. There was very, very little that I wasn't fond of.
What about you, Spence?
I say this movie passes, and I will give it a 5.
Wow, a 5.
Yeah. There's not many that are that good, but, like, they start off this movie with, like, clips of the real actors. And Samuel L. Jackson pops up and he's like, it took 14 years, but it was worth the wait. And I totally agree with him. It took a long time, but definitely worth it.
No, it's true. It did take a long time. And thankfully, this film does come off as a very well-polished story. It does resolve a lot of what you had expected from the first film, little bit of stories that you were wondering about. It delivers. Is, I guess, the easiest way to say. If you've been sitting on the bench waiting idly by for 14 years waiting for this film to be dropped, it definitely delivers for what you would come to expect as a follow-up to that 2004 hit.
Agreed.
So I would say this film definitely passes for me, and I'm going to give it 4.5 out of 5. I liked the film. I really did. I had a great time. It was fun, and I'm actually anxious to go and see it again. I'm... not as generous as Spencer, but I would say it's really up there. In terms of animated films, this has got to be one of the better animated films that we've seen in a long while coming out of Pixar.
I mean, it's instantly one of my favorite Pixar movies. It's
oh, wow.
Easily in the top four, possibly top three.
Yeah.
Well, there you
like,
go.
Like, right off the bat for me.
Well, let us know what you think. If you get a chance to see the film this upcoming weekend, let us know what you think on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers or our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. We'd love to hear your thoughts or if you think Spencer needs to really, you know, pick up his game on that soundboard. We'll definitely pass a message along.
Well, unnecessary roughness.
I'm not going to do it now because I'm not going to be good at it.
Yes, you will. If you need to know a couple other upcoming weekend releases, you got Tag, which is debuting this Friday, and like we said, Incredibles 2. So go check them out at your local theater, and we'd love to hear what you thought. This is a great film. It's a great conversation, and we hope you get to engage with us too, so we'd love to hear from you. But from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.